Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window, the podcast that takes you inside the biggest deals at the biggest clubs in world football. I'm Johnny McFarlane, and joining me are our transfer market insiders and pundits extraordinaire, Duncan Castles and Ian McGarry. This week, Eden Hazard is setting the Premier League alight after a summer of discontent when he looked certain to leave London. Will the Belgium star stay at Stamford Bridge now his new boss Maurizio Sarri has made him the creative hub of a dynamic new Chelsea side? We look at the controversy surrounding Marcus Rashford and whether the boy with a Roy of the Rovers spirit is ready to lead the line for one of the world's biggest clubs. And even Gazidis has been given carte blanche to reconstruct Arsenal. But now he's off to Milan. How will the North London club cope with even more flux at the top as Unai Emery tries to rebuild? Okay, before we start, gentlemen, welcome back, Duncan, from your butterfly excursions.
No butterflies involved. It's only Henry McRae can afford to spend his time chasing exotic butterflies in the regions of the world. I was actually arranging a monument to the maestro of Aberdeen football, Willie Miller at Malaga, but I'm struggling to get the money together for that statue of Willie running into Alan Hansen at the moment. If any of our listeners can help, I think it would look wonderful.
Well, away from Scottish football, because I'm sure that would bore everyone to tears if we talked about that too long, we are going to start with Eden Hazard. He has started the season on fire. 5 games, 5 goals, 2 assists, and a guy who looked pretty unhappy at times last season under the strictures of Antonio Conte looks completely freed up under his new boss, Maurizio Sarri. Ian, there was a lot of chat that perhaps Hazard's time had come and gone at Chelsea and he'd be on his way in the summer. It hasn't happened. And now he looks like a changed man. Do you think this means that Hazard's going to end up staying at Stamford Bridge?
I doubt that very much, Johnny. Unlike his Belgian teammate, Thibaut Courtois, who, let's not say he agitated for his move to Real Madrid, but he certainly made his mind up quite early on and in fact only recently admitted that he informed Chelsea in March of his decision that he wanted to leave and allowed them to sort out the details of that, etc., etc. Now, interestingly, Hazard this time next year, or sorry, I should say in June next year, will be in the same contract situation as Courtois, i.e. 1 year out of contract at Chelsea. He looks to me like a man very calm, very happy with his way of life right now. Sarri certainly has given him, you said, freed up. He's definitely given him freedom to play in a way that he prefers to play, i.e. right across the attacking midfield three, playing much more further forward and not restricted to starting on the wings, etc. The hat-trick last weekend was impressive, but no more than we come to expect of Hazard. My information is that one of the reasons he's so calm about his future is that he has concrete interest, if not offers, from three of Europe's biggest clubs, Real Madrid, Barcelona and Bayern Munich, for the season after this. And he may well choose one of those elite clubs to transfer to, and his contract situation being what it is, Chelsea would be forced into the situation which they were with Courtois, whereby either we allow him to go and get a decent fee for him, or we allow him to run his contract down and get nothing whatsoever. Now, if Hazard decides to leave, and I think he does believe, and I think those around him certainly believe it's time for something new for him to try further his career elsewhere, then at least Chelsea have, in this case, a good 7 months' notice in time to prepare to replace him, albeit, you know, players at his level are difficult to come by. So I think with Hazard, that sense of tranquility that we are seeing with regards to his situation right now is partly down to the fact that I think he knows his future is within his own hands, that he can choose amongst, you know, through the biggest clubs in the world. His ambition to win Champions League and other titles as well would certainly be heightened, if not certainly fulfilled, at either of those, any of those three clubs. And therefore, he's in a situation now where he can basically train, play, see what happens with Chelsea this season, all in the knowledge that come May or even earlier, he will be able to make a decision about his future next season. And so for a football player, you can that's the kind of dream scenario. You've made a decision to stay. You've got offers on the table to go to where you want to be. And therefore, you can just let things roll and see what happens for you in the season. As I said, in the knowledge that the move is there for you if you want it, when you want it.
Yeah, look, I think Chelsea need to assess this situation very carefully. They've offered Eden Hazard an improved contract last season, which would have made him the best paid player in the history of the club. Substantial rise in what he has now, and he didn't take it. He decided to try and get his move to Madrid in the summer. We saw him verbally push for that on a number of occasions, but they managed to retain him because he wasn't prepared to go all out to force the move then. I think Ian's analysis is a very good one. He's in a comfortable position. He's now the central attacking force in a team that's been reshaped around him. I know from people who know Hazard well, he's not the most aggressive of individuals. He's a guy who enjoys his family life, enjoys his downtime, enjoys his time on the pitch. But there's always been a question mark about whether he has the drive to turn himself into an absolute top-level player. So to go from the tier he's on to the tier where Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi have been. And that could be to Chelsea's advantage. If they can catch him during this season, a period where he is enjoying life, and enjoying football, scoring goals, being lauded for his play, offer him that contract again or an increase on it on the terms that they offered him last season, and catch him at a point where he signs, they could get him for essentially for the rest of his career because he's 27 now, will be 28 in January. That contract expires at a time where if he's going to leave this summer or leave by running it down to the end, that will be the last opportunity, a big contract for him, realistically. So if they can tie him down this season, by playing their cards right, catching him in the right mood, then they should have him for good. So if you know, if I was Marina Granovskaya, if I was Roman Abramovich looking at this situation, that's how I would be playing it strategically at present. If they still think that Eden Hazard is the player to build the club around, and I think there's a question mark there because I know last season, they were aware of the possibility of Hazard pushing for a move in the summer and they'd started to do the preparations for replacements in his position. So I do not rule out the possibility that were one of those clubs Ian mentioned to come up with a huge, significant offer that Chelsea felt was in their economic advantage relative to giving Hazard that record contract, that they would take it. But if they still think he's the man and they want to keep him into his 30s and pay him on those terms, then I think there is a window of opportunity for them to retain the player this season.
He's quite an interesting player in that he's not always had representation throughout his career. He went into his last deal with Chelsea without an agent. He just went in with a lawyer, I believe. What's his current status in terms of his representation and how unusual is that in the modern game?
It's not as unusual as you might think, Johnny. a lot of players are represented by a family member, and most, you know, significantly and famously, Neymar, represented by his dad. But what you have, obviously, is a coterie of advisors, mainly lawyers, accountants, etc., who will actually do the negotiations and who will survey and approve any contract offers, etc., etc. And Hazard is not different in that sense. His dad has a very big influence in his career. He has two lawyers who I understand are very trusted by the family and who have negotiated deals in the past. One of the things I'd say about Hazard's future is we should not underestimate the power of chat between teammates. Now, by that I mean Kevin De Bruyne has just signed a new deal with Manchester City worth in excess of £300,000 per week. Courtois has done likewise at Real Madrid. Hazard currently earns around £210,000 a week and is... contract at Chelsea. Clearly, to keep him, Hazard would value himself both at the same level as his international teammates De Bruyne and Courtois. So I would say if Chelsea's sort of managing director, Marina Gravskaya, etc., and other directors are going to put together a deal which will tempt Hazard to effectively, as Duncan said, see out his career at Stamford Bridge, then they will have to come up with figures close, if not in excess, of those which his current international teammates have signed at their respective clubs, Manchester City and Real Madrid. So why not Chelsea are prepared to commit to that? I'm not sure. Currently, their wage bill is not the highest in the Premier League. It used to be, it was for some years, but they've managed to sort of chip away and cut that back a little bit in the last sort of 3 to 5 years. We know that the investment at Chelsea has decreased year by year and is in danger of decreasing again because of the rather fluid status of Roman Abramovich's commitment to the club. Remember, the stadium rebuild has been put on hold. He himself, as we all know, has had his visa rejected in this country and has taken up Israeli citizenship instead. So I think Hazard's future has many, many facets which will influence what he does. But I suspect with him that it will be the ambition to fulfil his desire to win the Champions League more than one time, to realise his potential at, as Duncan rightly says, the peak of his career, and sign that one sort of mega contract, if you like, which will see him through the next 4 or 5 years. Well, that's at Chelsea. I'm not convinced. I think that Hazard has kind of coveted either the white shirt of Real Madrid or the Blaugrana of Barcelona for some time. And I think that the most likely outcome of this will be that he will move at the end of this season.
Obviously, Duncan, Eden Hazard, as I've said, has had an incredible start to the season. Is there anyone else that's making you stand up and take notice? Obviously, Liverpool have had a terrific start, and as well as Chelsea.
Look, I think you can't argue with 5 wins out of 5 in terms of points on the board. I still think the most impressive team at present in the Premier League is Manchester City. You look at the individual games that Chelsea and Liverpool have played. Chelsea were very fortunate to beat Arsenal, and I've had close things in some of their other matches. I'm not convinced about the structure of the team with Jorginho as a holding midfielder in front of a fairly suspect defence. So I really don't see that run continuing once they play more of the Premier League stronger teams in a better shape. I think they were lucky to get Arsenal so early in the season with Unai Emery trying to implement a lot of changes to his squad very rapidly. And Liverpool, it's interesting. I was talking to someone involved in recruitment the other day, and he said that that's the least impressive five game winning streak to the start of a Premier League season I've ever seen. And I have a bit of sympathy with that perspective, because I think in all of the games they've played, or almost all the games they've played, you've seen weaknesses and you've seen the possibility for them to drop points. I think they did absolutely what they needed to do against Tottenham. I was shocked that Pochettino set his team up that way, playing with a high defensive line against a Liverpool team that we all know loves to play teams that come onto them and give them space to play into.
Why do top coaches continue to do that, Duncan? Because he's not the only one. Roma did it as well against Liverpool. You'd think people would have cottoned on to this by now.
Roma did it. Manchester City did it. I genuinely don't know the answer to that question. I don't understand how someone like Pochettino, who we frequently laud for his coaching abilities, goes into a match like that thinking it's a good idea to push your defensive line up, and on top of that, play have both fullbacks as soon as you get the ball running beyond your midfielders. It's not complicated to know that Liverpool are just going to sit there and say, right, we'll grab possession of you and play you into the channels behind the centre backs and behind those full backs that pushed up and get our goals from there. It's very basic stuff. What is interesting about Liverpool is that they don't seem to be pressing quite as high up the pitch as they did previously. There seems to be a bit of a tactical change this season, in that they tended to try and win the ball immediately after the opposition got hold of it, and to try and do it as close to the opposition goal as possible. And the Tottenham game was quite a good example in that they were actually allowing Tottenham to come at them, and then they'd apply their press just inside their own half or in the middle of the field. So they'd allow Tottenham to pass the ball at the back, to push those fullbacks up, and then catch them in the middle. And yeah, perhaps it's because Tottenham were playing Eric Dier in midfield, and they knew that Dier, the strength of his game is not his passing. Ironically, it's a kind of Mourinho-like tactic to allow your opponents to give the ball to their weaker players and let them have the space to pass and pick off those mishit passes to launch your attack. So there has been a change in Liverpool. It's still the same fundamental counter press and counter-attack strategy. Get as quickly into your opponents as possible once you have the ball, but they're not doing it quite as high up the field in all the games. So that's interesting to see how that develops with them. This week's Champions League game is also a fascinating match to observe and see how this Liverpool copes with playing a team full of serious talent with a different manager in charge. I think the real tests are still there, and then we can make a decision about whether Liverpool are genuine contenders for the Premier League or not.
Ian, what do you make of the start to the season, and who do you think is going to give Manchester City the biggest challenge?
I'd say that Manchester City's dilemma, Pep Guardiola's challenge this season, is to compete to a level which is acceptable to the club's owners in the Champions League, and therefore having to split, if you like, that ambition between maintaining Premier League, a challenge there which would see them obviously attempt to defend the title for the first time since Manchester United won back-to-back titles, would be very, very difficult whilst trying to win the Champions League as well. You just have to look at the last 10, 15 years of Champions League winners to see how many clubs won the domestic title and won the Champions League, to see how difficult that is, Johnny. So I reckon that's going to be Guardiola and City's biggest challenge this season, because last year they were at the quarterfinal stage, at which point they already had a very healthy lead in the Premier League, and they just basically saw it out. They were like, the sort of the batting order down the line in cricket, who the night watchman, who just basically sees it out and makes sure the game is won in the Premier League. This year, I think to compete in both levels will be a massive and very different kind of scenario for them, and it's going to be interesting to see how the next few weeks pan out in terms of the group stages. Chelsea, I think, are not firing on all cylinders yet. under Sarri. I think there's still a lot of work to be done in order for Sarri to get his message across, if you like, because it's clear that they're having some close shaves with regards to results and conceding goals, etc., etc. Liverpool, for me, have probably the most impressive, but I agree with Duncan that they've not had exactly a difficult fixture list as yet. Tottenham being their most difficult opponent so far, and a Tottenham team who I thought set up very badly against them with a diamond midfield. It was very narrow when you think about you're playing against three of the best forward players in European football, two of which will play on the wing. So again, Liverpool's priorities changed very quickly last season. They concentrated on the Champions League when they knew that the Premier League was beyond them. This season, I think people expect, and certainly Liverpool fans expect, a Premier League challenge from their team. So Klopp, like Guardiola, will have a choice to make at some point, unless, of course, they get a massive slice of luck or a huge wave of motivation and momentum, which allows them to play in both competitions, the likes of which we've not seen in this country since 1999, when Manchester United won the treble. So I think at that point, you know, you can see how difficult it is when we have to go back as far as 1999 to see and to experience when a team actually managed to do both, i.e. win the Premier League and the Champions League in the same season.
I think Ian's spot on with that, the point, the difficulty Guardiola has, and we see it in the way Guardiola's been managing this season, is that can he meet Abu Dhabi's expectation of winning the Champions League while retaining the Premier League? We've seen Guardiola trying to downplay that from the very start. The first interview he gave after winning the Premier League, he was insistent that the priority was to win the Premier League again, not to win the Champions League, which is very different from the noises coming from Abu Dhabi. We've seen him talk about how he didn't expect to win by such a big margin again, saying it was impossible, saying the opponents would be a lot better, and saying that the key was for him was to keep the players motivated and to keep them at the top of their game. And, you know, I think you've just got to look at how he's dealt with Leroy Sané in the first part of the season, dropping him, leaving him entirely out of a matchday squad at one point. As a punishment for not applying himself properly in training. So you see Guardiola trying to ensure that key players, and Sané was a very important player for him last season, are at the same level as they were last season, because he knows he needs them to be there to achieve these goals. I think there were some other interesting things with Manchester City. They announced record revenues last week. They've gone over the £500 million mark for the first time, albeit with a huge chunk of commercial revenue. Their commercial revenue is almost £100 million more than any other club in the Premier League, apart from Manchester United, which, of course, you'd expect Manchester United to have such big revenues because they are hugely popular throughout the world and have concentrated in that for years. Manchester City, five of their big sponsors are from Abu Dhabi, so their big sponsors are essentially the people that own them. And there was also a letter from Sheikh Mansour, the titular owner of the club, which I found quite amusing, as he talked about how he was proud to be one of the Manchester City fans, so proud to be one of Manchester City's fans that in his 10 years of ownership, he has attended just one match in person. But, you know, PR is PR, isn't it?
Well, from one side of Manchester to the other, we haven't talked about Manchester United yet. They obviously had a bit of a sticky start, but two difficult away ties have been put to bed, and things seem to be on the up for Jose Mourinho's men. However, there has been a bit of controversy surrounding Marcus Rashford, with Rio Ferdinand the latest to question Jose Mourinho's use of the player. He said that essentially the Roy of the Rovers spirit that Rashford encapsulates has been curtailed under Jose. Duncan, what do you make of this?
Well, we've discussed Marcus Rashford a number of times in this podcast. The point seems to be that Marcus Rashford is one of England's great talents. Therefore, he should be starting for Manchester United at centre forward. is he ready to be the starting centre forward for Manchester United? I don't think he is. And more importantly, the coach of the club and his assistant coaches don't think he's ready to be the starting centre forward at Manchester United. Why isn't he ready? As we've discussed several times, he's pretty one-dimensional still in the way he plays. He wants to have space to run into. He wants to have the ball played ahead of him. He wants to be running onto the ball. And if you give him it in those circumstances, he is very good. He scores a lot of goals. He beats defenders for pace. And he worries them. But what he isn't doing on a regular basis, I'm not going to say he isn't capable of doing it, because you think from his physique, he should be able to do it because he's tall and he's muscular. He isn't able at present, or doesn't seem to want to take the ball with his back to goal, hold it and bring in teammates, or take the ball in the air, knock the ball on to other players, knock the ball back to other players, or control it in the air and bring it down. And you know, that's a fundamental quality that a centre forward in most teams. You can probably get away with not doing it at Manchester City because of the way they play, but in most clubs, you'd expect a centre-forward to be capable of that. So, you know, as Mourinho pointed out in his press conference, he's given Rashford a lot of playing time. I think, appeared in more matches as an outfielder than any other player under him, and the minutes are substantial. I saw Rio Ferdinand's argument. He's saying, comparing Rashford to previous stars that have come through. He says, if you think about the best players that come through, Michael Owen, Fabregas, Lampard, Gerrard, Kylian Mbappe, Rooney, these players played every game straight away. They start every game, which breeds confidence. Well, I'm afraid Rio Ferdinand, you know, maybe in his memory, these players started every game as soon as they became Premier League or top tier players, but the truth is very different. Frank Lampard, in his first two seasons in which he made 10 appearances or more, 30 starts in the Premier League, played 2,862 minutes. Gerrard, 2,585 minutes. Mbappe, and this is League One, this isn't the Premier League, 19 starts, 1,788 minutes. Rashford's got more than all of those. He's got almost as many as Wayne Rooney had playing for Everton. So, you know, one, it's not the case that these top players immediately come into teams and start every game. And two, is Rashford actually at the same level as these players? You know, sometimes you get young players who come in and in their first, you know, season, first two seasons in the Premier League, they're outstanding and they catch everyone by surprise because they didn't expect them to have that ability straight off the bat. And some of these players don't develop, or they don't get much better than they are at that stage. I know Mourinho thinks Rashford can turn into a top player, mainly, I think, because he likes his mental attitude, and he likes his willingness to learn on top of the technical attributes he's got. But Rashford still has to prove that he can develop into that level of player, and there's no guarantee. He's placing him on a par with the best young footballer in the world at present, a former Ballon d'Or winner, and you know, four or five of the best Premier League players of the last two decades. I'm not sure Marcus Rashford is going to become one of the best Premier League players of the next decade. I think he will be a very good footballer, but that still has to be proven. So that the level of expectation around the player, I think, exceeds what he has delivered on the football field so far.
I think it's important to contextualise the Rashford debate, and without being too cynical about how these things come about, when a young English talent scores two goals for England in consecutive games, that goal in each game, etc., then the agenda is more or less set for the coming two or three days, and that will be always his performance stroke appearances for his club. Why is it that this young man's not playing more for Manchester United? Why is he not scoring more goals? Why are his appearances and goals ratio what they are instead of what they might be, given his performances for his country? I've seen it so many times, it's quite boring. And that's why I said initially I want to avoid being cynical about it. Sometimes the agenda is effectively written for you as a journalist or as a someone in the media. And there's not much to talk about more than Rashford's performances and compare them to his time at Manchester United. And indeed, as a subtext to all this, there's also been a debate about Phil Foden at Manchester City and why he doesn't get game time at Manchester City. Time which, in comparison to Rashford's, is you know, his is minuscule, Foden, albeit he's younger and less experienced. But Rashford's minutes, as Duncan's pointed out, have been significant. So, in terms of the bandwagon, the Rashford bandwagon building and creating more and more noise, I think it's understandable in the circumstances. But I think what Jose Mourinho has done is contextualised it very, very well. He has brought up a series of statistics which point out exactly why or how many games or how many minutes Rashford has played. And the fact that as manager of Manchester United, his job is to win football matches. And if Rashford is not justifying game time with goals scored or chances created, then it's his job not to pick him and to pick other players who will do better, which is exactly what he's done. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with that. What's wrong, or what's not even what's wrong, but what is happening is that it's being compared to his game time with England. And those two things are incomparable. England play around 10 matches per year. Manchester United play around 55 to 60, depending on how far they go in cup competitions. So you can't actually compare the two in terms of their equality of performance for one single player. It just doesn't work like that. I don't think that Rashford at this moment in time looks to me like a Wayne Rooney did when he was his age. In fact, if anything, it reminds me of Danny Welbeck, who, and we all know how his career has gone, both at Manchester United and since he moved to Arsenal. Okay, there are excuses there with injuries, et cetera, but at the same time, many, many players, especially strikers, have burst onto the scene and looked amazing, but then not really fulfilled potential. Now, it's really up to Rashford if he wants to fulfil his potential. I think it's interesting that his mental attitude is admired by Mourinho, but he's got to convert his talent into effectiveness. I think he's looked upon at Manchester United, from what I've heard from coaching staff there, as someone who can waste chances and waste possession. And that habit or indeed the desire in him to have the ball at his feet and run from wide areas into central areas and then produce a shot means that he puts the ball at risk, he puts possession at risk, which is something Mourinho doesn't like. Now, there's a time and place for all of that, but until he can justify in the way that, let's say, we talked about Eden Hazard earlier, who can dribble and take possession and take control of the ball and then produce either a goal or chance created, then Rashford right now is nowhere near in that league. And so what he needs to do is improve his game in order to justify minutes on the pitch and the trust and loyalty of his coach. Because it's much easier for Gareth Southgate to be loyal to Marcus Rashford than it is for Jose Mourinho.
Look, we can look at it two ways. As far as I understand it, Manchester United aren't a development football club. I mean, I hear them talked about it sometimes, and that this history of bringing through players from their academy, and I hear fans saying they'd be happy just with a team of younger talents coming through. But I think they're still trying to win the Premier League. At least their manager is, and their players are, and they're trying to win the Champions League. So if that's the case, from the football club's point of view, they have to put the best person to play centre forward at present in the team. And I think the assessment is fair that of their current squad, Marcus Rashford isn't the best person to be at centre forward. Romelu Lukaku is the best player they've got for that position. But you could also look at it from the player's perspective. If Marcus Rashford was the starting centre-back at Manchester United, had been for the last two seasons, in this period of expectation that United have to get the title back and have to be competitive in the Champions League, and he failed to deliver, which the expectation should be that he will fail to deliver because his game isn't rounded enough for it yet. doesn't have the full attributes to play as a centre forward, then where does that leave Marcus Rashford? Because the same media, the same commentary that are happy to say Marcus Rashford is being held back by the way he's being used at Manchester United, we then start talking about, well, he's not performing. He's not doing what's required of a Manchester United striker. They need to change. So is that the best for Marcus Rashford, to be overexposed at centre-forward for Manchester United, or to be used as he's being used, which is given a lot of playing time, a lot of opportunities, and the development of his career still at Manchester United, but not in that potentially very painful limelight of being the man who's expected to provide the majority of goals for a team who's expected to win the Premier League title?
Another player that's caused a lot of conversation and controversy is Anthony Martial. And I believe, Duncan, that you have some news on his situation.
Yeah, there were a few reports last week that Manchester United did not sell Martial in the summer window because AS Monaco, his previous club, held a right within their original transfer agreement with Manchester United that they got 50% of either the profit on a transfer or 50% of the transfer fee were they to sell them. I've checked that with people at Monaco and they tell me there's no sell-on clause. And that Monaco have no entitlement to any money from a transfer fee were Manchester United to sell him, which isn't really a surprise given that when United bought Martial, he was the most expensive teenager in world football, and they agreed a deal that went up to €80 million where three performance clauses reached during the spell of his contract. In other words, United paid a lot of money for the player in the first place. So you wouldn't expect there to be a sell-on clause in a deal of that nature. And secondly, when you go to a club like Manchester United, generally those clubs don't put sell-on clauses in deals to start with. So you can forget about that being a factor. Martial wasn't sold because Woodward was worried about not making enough money on the deal. He was not sold because Woodward wanted to retain him at the club because he feels he is a player that should be developed at Manchester United and shouldn't be allowed to go elsewhere, even if the manager, even if the player wanted to leave, his agent was trying to get him a move, and the manager felt that in those circumstances, the most pragmatic solution would be to take a deal on the table. And there were a number of deals on the table and invest the money elsewhere in the team.
Okay, we'll move on to Arsenal now. Ivan Gazidis is in the process of leaving the club. He will be replaced by Raul Sanley, who's becoming head of football, and Vinay Venkatesham as managing director. This is the latest in a long list of changes that have happened at Arsenal since Arsene Wenger departed. Ian, how do Arsenal fans view this? It's an enormous amount of change that's happened at their club, and change it can often result in good positives, but in this situation, with such strong competition for the Premier League, surely Arsenal are in a situation now where they're looking at a long, long way back to the very, very top of the game with a lot of people now coming in and having to make a lot of changes.
I think the first thing to point out, Johnny, is that Gazidis was Stan Kroenke, the now full owner of Arsenal Football Club after his purchase of Alisher Usmanov's shares 3 weeks ago, was his, if you like, his marquee appointment as chief executive. He came from the United States, where Kroenke obviously has his sports franchises, and was put into Arsenal to effectively run the business in the same way that Kroenke expects, or indeed has experience of running his sports franchises in the USA. And you have to say that in the almost 10 years that he's been there, in terms of performance on the pitch, as Jose Mourinho might say, he has been a specialist in failure. No Premier League titles, no Champions League titles, some FA Cup success, yes, but generally presided over a period in Arsenal's history which has been as fallow as almost any has been in the modern era. So what's his legacy? I think, you know, 10 years at a club which does generate an awful lot of money, a club which has incredible tradition and expectation of being at the top of not just the domestic game, but European football as well. And you'd have to say the most impressive thing about him has been his salary that he takes home, because it's long been something which has irked Arsenal fans that Gazidis' basic salary was £2.62 million plus bonuses. And many believed, and I think it is the case, that he benefited from saving money, which is not unusual in a CEO's role of any big organisation or company. But at the same time, when success is judged by your customers on the pitch and not on the balance sheet, then you'd have to say that Gazidis has failed. And the fact that he's now walking out, having presided over and indeed appointed a new director of football, or head of football as he's now known, as well as chief scout, as well as presiding over the departure of Arsene Wenger. And you have to say that you get the feeling that he is he's jumping ship at the wrong time, because he's not taking responsibility now for how the club has run. He's taken a big pay rise, reportedly of around an extra £1 million a year, to join AC Milan, where an American hedge fund company now owns the controlling interest there. So you've got to say that it looks like he's got to Milan to make money for his new bosses, in the way that he made money for Stan Kroenke at Arsenal. But it's the same old for Arsenal fans. They're asking themselves always, why are we not investing enough money in the squad? Why are the team underperforming? Why are they underachieving? We've got a new manager at last. We've now got new people who have been promoted internally, who you've got to believe that is a Stan Kroenke thing. He would rather have more control stroke secrecy about the way that Arsenal Football Club is run than certainly more openness and transparency, which has disappeared, of course, since he bought Usmanov's shares, because there were no longer shareholders' meetings, because he's the sole shareholder. So I think it's a very poor situation that Gazidis left in his wake, and also the fact that the appointments to replace him have become very quickly and internally mean that there would be less accountability for Stan Kroenke at Arsenal, and therefore less accountability for to be explained to Arsenal fans as well, with regards to investment in the team as well as performance or achievement. And I think it's just another blow for them, to be honest. And as someone who covered Arsenal in those glory years, when they were the Invincibles, when they won double-doubles under Arsene Wenger and had probably one of the greatest and most entertaining football teams in Premier League history, I feel quite sad. I feel quite sad. I think this is just yet another blow for a support who have been incredibly loyal despite disappointment, and now see their club yet again, if you like, I wouldn't say disadvantaged, because I'm not saying that Gazidis was a massive advantage for the playing side, but the fact that that his replacements are yes men, I think, is probably a very bad sign.
I'm just looking at Gazidis' statement about his departure, and he's saying here, "I know many will think this is a strange time to be leaving, but I believe it's the right time for me and for the club. Change in succession is not only inevitable for a club like Arsenal, it's necessary if it is continually to keep moving forward." So you've got the man himself essentially trying to make excuses for why he's departing at what is really a very bizarre time. As Ian said, Gazidis has been given carte blanche to change Arsenal's essentially entire management structure. Pretty much everyone in the football club above the first team, coaching staff, support staff, scouting staff, manager, have gone in the space of sort of just over a year. to be replaced by Gazidis-led appointments. A huge revolutionary turnover in the way Arsenal is operated. And the man who was allowed to lead that process decides to leave for another club in another country, reportedly for a very significant pay rise and for a percentage of the share capital of Milan, the club he's going to run now. That's Gazidis' decision. What's interesting to me is that Stan Kroenke hasn't kept him at the club. So Stan Kroenke has had Gazidis there for 10 years. He's entrusted him with this process of running Arsenal Football Club, keeping it profitable, increasing its value to him. He's entrusted him with that revolutionary change of staff, with the removal of Arsene Wenger, with the replacement of a new manager, all the new people around him. And when his key man is headhunted by another American, a set of businessmen, to look after their football club and offered reportedly a significant pay rise, Stan Kroenke decides he's not prepared to match that and isn't prepared to offer Gazidis terms to retain him at the club. And if, you know, Ivan Gazidis was the star striker for Arsenal, the key element on the playing field, you'd expect Stan Kroenke to go out of his way to retain him, to avoid him going to competition. But that hasn't happened. So what's clear is Arsenal are losing someone who was very well valued by their owner, who wasn't able to keep him there. And that, again, makes you ask questions about what Stan Kroenke really wants for Arsenal Football Club and how far he's prepared to go to ensure they have the best personnel and the best chance of succeeding on the football pitch. Or is that not really that important to Stan Kroenke? Is he happy enough with Arsenal as long as it's turning over a significant profit each year? A chunk of that goes back to him and his family, and the long-term value of Arsenal remains high. And when he decides, if he decides that he wants to sell the club, he can take a big profit on the price he paid for the shares in Arsenal Football Club.
Okay, we're going to move on now to our legendary quickfire round. Today, we're going to look at the Champions League with it starting this week. And we're going to have a look at the top eight sides that have the best chance of taking home that trophy at the end of the season and ask whether or not they are worth a flutter or you'd have to be a nutter to bet on them. We're going to start with you, Ian. Manchester City, the favourites, 9-2.
I'd say worth a flutter rather than being a nutter on this one, Johnny. I do think that the pressure from Abu Dhabi is on Guardiola and his squad to produce a much more impressive campaign than they did last season, when, of course, they lost very easily in the end to Liverpool in the quarterfinal stage. They have by far the most amount of quality in their squad, certainly in the Premier League, and I would argue that outside of Barcelona, that probably extends to European football as well. Their problem will be, as we've mentioned already, that sustaining Premier League form, rotating players, and still making it to those the crucial stages when it comes to knockout stages in February, March, April. Next year. So I think anyone would be a nutter not to bet them if you really wanted a run for your money. So therefore, I'd say flutter, not nutter.
Okay, second favourites, Duncan, Barcelona, 11-2.
Well, I'd be interested to know what European odds are on both of these clubs, because I'd be very surprised if on the continent they have Manchester City, who've not got beyond the quarterfinal stage and been knocked out by inferior sides in the last two goes at the tournament as favourites with their bookmakers, as opposed to the English bookmaking market. As for Barcelona, definitely worth a bet if you're so inclined. Still got the core of a team that won La Liga comfortably last season and are very much focused on the Champions League this season, particularly their key player, Lionel Messi. I think when you see Messi talking about the importance of winning the Champions League to him and to the club, you can take note and expect him to be on the very best of his form in those games. So, yeah, they're a good bet.
PSG, Ian, it's 15-2.
Interestingly, they would be a sort of middle outsider bet, I think. Again, their history of the competition has been relatively impressive in recent years. Clearly, they have a very talented squad. They have the benefit, I believe, of being able to cruise in Ligue 1. Although I think Marseille, Lyon are probably equipped to challenge to a degree, but I do think that PSG get to the point where they're in the quarterfinals, semifinals of the Champions League, as they have been in the last 4 years, having already almost won the title in France. And I think that might be a disadvantage to them. As Duncan has pointed out before on the podcast, this was something which affected Guardiola's Bayern Munich. They'd won the title so early on that when they got to the latter stages of the Champions League, the motivation and the momentum had actually lost, and also their physical capacity to cope with the intensity of Champions League knockout football had degraded as well. And I think that's probably PSG's biggest challenge. I think they're probably worth a bet because they're such a talented squad. And with a little bit of luck, then maybe they get to the final. And at that point, you know, it's anyone's to call. So I'd say, yeah, I would say flutter rather than nutter.
Bayern Munich, Duncan, 8-1.
I'd probably want better odds than that for Bayern Munich, to be honest. They've got a new coach who is untested at this level. They haven't done a lot of reinforcement work in the summer. They've been there or thereabouts season after season, but there's been an inability to translate that into final success, albeit I think they were handicapped under Guardiola in that they had this tactical dogmatism about them, which we've seen with Guardiola at Manchester City, always playing the same way and getting picked off by the better teams who adapt to that style of play and who have a similar level of players. So I don't think they're quite there for this season. I would avoid that. I'd avoid the bet at that price.
A bet for nutters, Duncan.
A bet for the Johnny McFarlanes of this world, along with Liverpool.
Well, I'll keep Liverpool for you, Duncan, actually. Juventus, Ian, 15-2.
Very interesting. I'd prefer longer odds if I was going to take a flutter on this one, Johnny, because they're becoming a little bit of the Leverkusen of Champions League football. But the addition of Cristiano Ronaldo obviously is something which no one can ignore. So, yeah, with Ronaldo's experience and winning mentality in the Champions League, that's a massive boost for Juventus. Someone who I think can get them over the line in the Champions League. They've got a very, very efficient team ethic at Juventus, and Allegri obviously has been there and built up a squad and indeed a playing style which has yet to conquer Europe, but at the same time has come very close. I think Ronaldo may well be the missing link, and I don't think anyone would be surprised if that were the case. So I would say, if you're going to take an outside bet or you know, flutter on decent odds, try and get Juventus. Maybe not at 15-2, but maybe, yeah, take them if they get a draw in the group stage and their odds go out a bit, get some money on then.
Duncan, it's almost bizarre to see Real Madrid so far down the bookies' odds, but they are at 8-1.
Yeah, I think they're probably worth a bet at that price. I can understand why they've come down the odds to a certain extent, because they've lost the best player in the Champions League and they won three times in a row. You have to question how many times the same group of players can reach the pinnacle in the toughest competition. Also, there's a huge amount of pressure on them to win La Liga this season, so you'd suspect that more of their focus would be on that competition. But, you know, they still have a lot of quality in their squad. I actually think that Ian's had the team there. I think if there's one club to bet on in this year's Champions League, I would fancy Juventus, because although they've had teething problems fitting Ronaldo into the system, they've been so close in recent years, consistently good. They've got the best player in the competition in the squad, and Allegri has shown himself to be extremely capable at coming up with the right permutation of players and tactics throughout his time at Juventus. He's had previous seasons where he's had difficult starts, and he's come up with solutions every time. So I really fancy them.
Ian, Atletico Madrid. They are 11-1. Nice wee bet, I think.
Do you know what? This is a club that have been there, thereabouts, obviously, in both Europa League and Champions League in recent years, Johnny. And it's their story has been a little bit sort of, you know, not the fairy tale, if you like. It's been the antithesis of the fairy tale. They've got very, very good players. They've got, Allegri at Juventus, a manager who's been there and been able to create something from foundation up the way. They will compete with anyone that they come across. You can't rule them out. I just wonder again about the mentality of the players when they get to that final point, which is where they've managed to fail in recent times, and whether or not, unlike Juventus, who have signed Ronaldo, the best player in the Champions League, as Duncan said, where they have the mentality to get themselves over the line. So I would put them between flutter and nutter. I would prefer, if I were anyone out there looking at a bet on Atletico, I would say wait until the see how they perform in the group stage before you get your money on there.
And finally, Duncan, you're always a man who likes to keep our Scouse listenership on their toes and happy and excited. So I've kept this one for you. 11-1, Liverpool, last year's finalists. What's your prediction?
As I said before I went on holiday, I could see them going out in the group stage. I think there's a definite risk there, and we'll find out a lot about that tonight with the Paris Saint-Germain game, how that goes for them. I don't see them as winners. I think they overperformed in last season's Champions League, both in the quarterfinal and the semi-final. Teams came up and set up exactly the way they needed them to set up, which allowed them to get through to the final. I saw Jurgen Klopp yesterday talking about how everyone in football could see that if their moment had been right, they could have won that final. I just don't get that. I don't get his reinterpretation of the Champions League as something that they were unlucky not to win. I think the better team won, and they won comprehensively. I don't see them getting to a final again. I don't see them winning it. Atletico, yeah. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I think or two, when the draw came out, I do like them as an outside bet, maybe an each way bet on those odds, because the reasons Ian's mentioned, they managed to retain their top players. They've got a lot of quality in that squad, and they've got a very pragmatic manager who's showed himself being extremely competent at getting that team to finals, or very, very close to winning the Champions League a few years ago, and they've taken a couple of Europa League trophies. So they know what's required to get to the final, and they might just have enough if the circumstances are right to win it too.
Johnny, before we go, I just want to say my alternate quickfire round today, and I'll be very quick with this, was who would be the player you'd most like to have a chicken curry with? Now, I don't know if you saw this, but
I'm more of a lambuna man myself.
I can see that in your face. N'Golo Kante missed his Eurostar train last Saturday night home to see friends and family in Paris, and went to a local mosque in King's Cross, and instead bumped into an Arsenal fan who invited him back, as is the way in Muslim culture, to have dinner. He said yes, and he spent the next 4 hours having a chicken curry, playing FIFA with this bloke and his mates, and watching himself in Match of the Day. Now, that is quality. I just love the idea that a Premier League superstar, a World Cup winner, can turn up at someone's house, having been invited, have a nice meal, play a bit of FIFA, watch Match of the Day, There's not enough of that in modern football. And so therefore, maybe next week we can do which player you would most like to invite to your house for a chicken curry.
Okay, well, we can certainly... I'll take that under advisement, Ian. Thank you. And with that chicken-related story, I'm going to have to slam this particular transfer window shut. Just a reminder that we are looking for a sponsor, so if you like the idea of partnering with one of the UK's best football podcasts and talking directly to our listeners about your brand, get in touch through our social media channels. To continue the debate, we are all on Twitter and even have our own transfer window account at Transfer Podcast. We're trying to build a community on that account so everyone who follows will get a follow back. If you want to speak to us directly, I'm at Johnny R. McFarlane, and most importantly, our pundits are at Duncan Castles and at Garbo SJ. If you like the podcast, and we know thousands of you do, give something back by popping onto iTunes and giving us a 5-star review. This helps us reach as many listeners as possible, and the bigger the community, the more we can give you. It's that simple. We'll be back next Tuesday before 3 p.m. Until next time, thanks for listening.